series of tax evasion stories based upon a leak. It was, from the point of cross-border reporting, it was probably one of the largest cross-border stories, the largest cross-border story I know of anyway, and I've tried to follow them as good as I could. So there was 86 journalists from more than 40 countries, is I think the latest status. We have this panel here. We had scheduled a panel immediately afterwards, which is now postponed to tomorrow morning 9:30. This just as information spread the news. So we have the panel here now. We have another one tomorrow morning 9:30, and we have a tech panel later tomorrow, but that is not changed according to schedule. So here on the panel we have David Lee from The Guardian, or he is not at The Guardian anymore. He celebrated his retirement recently, which, which we are quite sad about, but we owe him wholeheartedly. And we have Duncan Campbell, who is a freelance journalist and has been with the ICIJ team, and Mark Cabra, who is also a freelance journalist and with the ICIJ team. And the, you have exact titles within the team, but I leave that to you. Now, one of the reasons one of the first questions I, or when before the offshore leaks broke this spring, we had scheduled you here on this conference, and I wanted to talk with David about the previous tax evasion coverage. And because also before the offshore leaks broke, the OECD published a report saying, thanking explicitly The Guardian, The New York Times and others for their reporting about this, because there has been tax evasion reporting also without a leak. Then came the leak. Duncan was particularly focusing on the data of this immense leak, and they'll tell you about how immense it was. And then Mark came in and helped coordinate this immense, this large group of journalists all over the place. So I think we should end as also following up now with the political reactions to it. So let's start with David, then hand over to Duncan, and then Mark.
Okay, right. Well, I will just take a few minutes to take you through the first part of the history of this massive offshore leak, and then Duncan will perhaps pick up where I left off. 3 years ago, nearly now, the WikiLeaks leak astonished the world, it's fair to say, with what was, at the end of it, 1.65 gigabytes of leaked data. All of which we thought was enormous at the time when we did a cross-border collaboration that ended up with five different newspapers. We thought this was a huge leak and hugely difficult to manipulate. With hindsight, we were wrong because it was easy, relatively easy to manipulate. All the data was in a very structured form because it was US Army situation reports, and it was US State Department cables back to Washington. And each of those two types of material was constructed in a very rigid way. They were told how to do it. You know, you fill in this field, you fill in that field, here's where you put in where it's from, here's where you put in who it's to, here's where you put what the classification is, all of which made it very easy to take these spreadsheets, which is what the war report were, and just documented text, which is what the cables were. It turned out to be relatively easy to put those in a searchable form and present them to the world in a journalistically meaningful manner. Now, we move on a year to the GIJC Journalism Conference in Ukraine. That's a terrifically bad slide. You can just about see the word journalism. There are a lot of people like this got together in Kiev. You were there too, weren't you? Yeah, we're all there. And this is where the seeds were laid for the new mighty piece of leaked data. The man behind it, who I remember coming up to me excitedly at Kiev and saying, you know, I've got something amazing. Words I last heard from Julian Assange before that. This is Gerard Ryle, an Australian journalist. He used to be deputy editor of the Canberra Times. I think he worked for the Fairfax Organization in Australia. He then moved over to Washington, D.C. to head the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, the ICIJ. For those of you who don't know, this is a non-profit organization that's concentrated on cross-border work that sprang out of a larger organization called the Center for Public Integrity in Washington, run very successfully, launched more than a decade ago by Chuck Lewis, who some of you might know. So basically, for all its grand title, a struggling NGO looking for donors and looking for projects. And Gerard brought with him to ICIJ, very much as his dowry from Australia, a hard drive, and the hard drive contained not 1.65 gigabytes, but 200 gigabytes of data. Not only was it much, much bigger than WikiLeaks, it was also much, much messier. What it consisted of was the internal files of a couple of big incorporation agencies in the British Virgin Islands that set up offshore companies. And what we had in it was company documents going back 15 years in all kinds of formats. There were internal memos, there were masses of emails, millions of emails, some in formats nobody was using anymore. There were scanned copies of people's passports, I think, you know, at one extreme, and simple text documents at the other. So the whole thing was an enormous, and it was a huge mess. As a result of working very hard with software that I was certainly very unfamiliar with, and eventually, as Duncan will tell you, with innovative software which he designed himself, it became possible to search the material and to research the material and to perform a journalistic exercise on it to get some truths out of it. So that it didn't just become a pile of data, but became something which could illuminate the world and maybe even change the world a bit. A year on after that, it took a year for us to get this far, the first fruit of this collaboration was published. And this was a joint exercise between The Guardian, where I was investigations editor at the time, the BBC, who put together a panorama investigative program where they went did some undercover reporting, and ICIJ itself. We called the series Offshore Secrets, and we began to start to do what I think was a very exciting thing, which was to destroy, or at least damage, the secrecy on which offshore companies depend. Because with secrecy, it becomes possible to evade tax. It also becomes possible to commit various crimes. It also becomes possible, we discovered, to hide assets from your ex-wife and things like that. And it turned out that all over the world, people who had either government contracts or ex-wives or other things that they wanted to conceal were flocking to offshore jurisdictions, one in particular, in order to hide their wealth. And we could now name those people. We found in this data the means of naming a lot of those people. The first journalistic achievement that came out of the material was to expose the British Virgin Islands, the BVI. This is the biggest offshore jurisdiction in the world. Since the 1980s, when they launched their offshore jurisdiction in a big way, they've incorporated more than 1 million offshore companies. There's only one thing they sell and only one reason why people buy it, and that is secrecy. Because if you have a BVI offshore company, no information of any meaningful kind is published about it, and certainly not the information about who actually owns the company, who is the beneficial owner. So we were able to expose in a detailed way how the BVI had been, you know, living off secrecy and, you know, to an extent, living off crime. The consequence there was immediate. This is one former British ambassador who's campaigned against corruption who described what an embarrassment the BVI had become as a result. He said, "The cost and damage inflicted on other countries by our loose regime at home and abroad makes us vulnerable to charges of hypocrisy and worse." And this is Matthew Oakeshott, Lord Oakeshott, who is a senior politician in the Lib Dem politician in the coalition government that currently is that runs the British government. And he said, "How can David Cameron keep a straight face calling for the GA to make big business pay tax when we let the BVI use British law and British protection to suck in billions in dirty money?" So we got a very quick reaction there. And the G8 is, of course, meeting very shortly, chaired by Britain, when tax transparency is going to be at the top of the agenda. Second thing we got out of this data was lists of identities of people who owned half the properties in London. For those of you who don't know, it's possible in Britain to buy a house and register it in the name of an offshore company, such as in the BVI, so that nobody knows who the owner of the property is. And thousands, literally, of UK properties are now owned in the name of offshore companies. This has made the UK's land registry, their property registry, increasingly meaningless because it's supposed to be public, but it now tells you nothing worth knowing. So we blew a lot of that open. We were able to construct interactive maps. I mean, we did a bit of data visualization here. So you could go in on this Google map and you could click on an address, and up would come what we knew about who the real owner was. And a lot of the people who do this, they're Russian oligarchs, Ukrainian oligarchs, Chinese oligarchs, Lithuanian oligarchs, all these people who flock to London because if they keep it secret and they register themselves offshore, they get tax breaks. Britons as well can pretend to be offshore companies and get the same tax breaks, which is tax evasion, but it's easy to do if nobody knows who is behind the corporate veil. The third thing that we were able to expose out of this data as a result was what we call sham directors, the dummy directors, nominee directors. And these are the people whose names appear even on the internal company data that we got, posing as the directors of companies. And they were all people who gave addresses in the most obscure places imaginable. The woman running 1,200 companies, for example, Sarah Petrie Mears, the address she gave was on the island of Nevis, which I didn't really know existed. For those of you who still don't know, it's in the Caribbean. The jurisdiction is called St. Kitts and Nevis, and it's two islands, and they hate each other, so... St. Kitts runs itself, and Nevis sort of runs itself, and it runs itself by providing addresses to fake directors. And it also has a bogus company registry.
And will sell you a passport.
And will sell you a passport, will it? Probably sell you a diplomatic status as well, if you ask nicely.
Fair enough.
Final thing, and I mention this because you might think that you can only do these kind of data exercises with leaks. And it's true that leaks provide the most wonderful material. But one of the things that we dug up alongside this was that there were thousands and thousands of UK individuals running UK-registered companies who gave addresses offshore, not just in the BVI, but in all kinds of other places You see, we did a table there. Isle of Man, Guernsey, Cyprus, Jersey, Dubai, Seychelles, St. Kitts and Nevis, and so on. I think we identified 142,000 of such people. That isn't a leak. We did that simply by taking the public business registry, the company registry in the UK, and a group of people called Duodil scraped it for us and came up with these figures, which weren't a secret, but nobody had done it before. And in this context of this sort of offshore swindling, you know, it was very illuminating. And the final thing I would say about the British end of this is that although we exposed lots and lots of identities of people doing this, and we hope damaged the confidence of rich people in the idea that they could set up a BVI company and no one would ever know, it's led to a lot of fine words about there will be reforms, but we have yet to see the real reform, which would be to make jurisdictions like the BVI reveal the true beneficial owner of these companies. So until that happens, it will all carry on. After we did this exercise last October, Gerard Ryle, Duncan Campbell, and others then moved on to a much bigger phase in which they didn't just focus on the British end of it, but they went worldwide. And this was where the truly enormous collaboration took place and the truly pioneering advances in data journalism, I think, took place. And this is where I should hand over to Duncan.